From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, Kim McQueen is going to interview Nick Sharma about his new cookbook, Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food. Before I turn it over to Kim, I'll just give you a little background on Nick Sharma. He's the writer, photographer, and recipe developer behind the critically acclaimed blog, A Brown Table. His meteoric rise in the food scene has brought him two IACP Digital Media Awards and a Savour Best Food Blog Award finalist spot. His visual food column for the San Francisco Chronicle, A Brown Kitchen, runs weekly in print and online. He was also featured in America, the great cookbook that contains recipe from 100 top chefs and cooks from around the country. He lives in Oakland, California, with his husband and two pets. Kim McQueen is a semi-regular guest host on Write the Book. She serves as faculty advisor to students in the professional writing, creative, media, communications, and film programs at Champlain College, and is managing editor for the Center for Publishing at Champlain. She's author of the books People Who Hate America and Out, Out, and she received an MFA in creative writing, creative nonfiction writing from Bay Path University this year. All right, I'm going to turn it over to Kim now. I hope you enjoy her conversation with Nick Sharma.
Thank you so much for being here with us today, Nick. And I loved this book, this absolutely gorgeous cookbook. And we're going to talk about the book today and about your sort of path to publication.
Okay.
Yeah, and I wanted to start out by asking you if you would kindly read to us from the first column of the introduction to this book.
Of course, I'd be more than happy to do that. The world is getting smaller. The advent of new technologies has changed and shaped the way we interact and think. The internet lets us explore new cultures and countries in ways we never thought would be possible. Migrant communities have brought their cultures to our doorsteps, and the foods they've shared with us have become powerful tools of education and social justice. Today, both home cooks and chefs have a new global palette of ingredients and spices to play with. We now mention cardamom in the same breath with vanilla, and ghee is a common staple on the shelves of many grocery stores. Mango lassi? Well, it needs no introduction. Our interconnected world has transformed how we think about food and changed the way we eat. I am an immigrant, and I tell my story through food. Season is a collection of my experiences and tastes, but this book is more than just a book of recipes. Here you will find my approach to cooking. When I cook, my thought process is influenced not only by my childhood in India, but also how I was shaped by my experiences while I acclimated to my adopted new home in America, using food as a tool to communicate. This is not a traditional Indian cookbook, though I've included a few of my favorite recipes. Instead, consider it as a guide to bringing new flavors from different culinary traditions into your own kitchens and making them work for you. I take pride in incorporating flavors, techniques, and ingredients in new and exciting ways. This, my first book, celebrates diverse cultural influences, and I hope helps to raise labels like ethnic and exotic in the West by shedding more light on some of these ingredients. Season is a collection of flavors from my two worlds, India and America.
That's excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So this introduction really struck me as just really, first of all, beautifully written, also beautifully photographed, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But the introduction really serves as a geographical and a culinary tour of your life. You're born in India, and you come to America not really to cook, but to study genetics.
Right.
At one point, you had a career working for the Department of Medicine at Georgetown, running pharmaceutical studies. So can you start us off by talking about how you got from there to cooking?
So, you know, this was one of, the book has been an amazing experience, but what I guess where everything began was when I lived in India. I started to cook as a child, and one of the things growing up in a family where my parents came from two different parts of the country. My mom is Roman Catholic, and her family comes from a Portuguese colony called Goa. And so their food was very West Coast influenced. Coconut, you'd see a lot of coconut, you'd see a lot of meat. It was Western influenced on top of that. And then my dad's family was from a Brahmin Hindu family. And so you had a lot of vegetarian food and dairy products. And they would cook these meals and serve them at the table without, and I really didn't pay attention to it as a child. I guess no one really does, at least I didn't. But you had all these things that you would never really see at a restaurant or in someone who had grown in a much more traditional family where everyone came from the same place. I didn't have that. And it always made sense to me that you could have things that really don't kind of fit, but they actually do. And I'm really thankful to my parents for kind of making that happen for me as a child. I mean, it was unintentional, but it worked out. And then I moved to America for graduate school, and I studied at the College of Medicine at Cincinnati, Ohio. And one of the things that happened there was, again, I was on a student budget. I did not grow up rich, so food and encyclopedias were my window to the world. And so, again, on a student stipend, you don't make much money. Mm. And I started exploring the local food scene, eating at restaurants, trying to figure out what was different. And fortunately, we live in a country where we have people from all over the world. So in Cincinnati, I had access to Greek food, to German food, to Indian food, to Italian food. And so all these influences were around me, and I just started having fun. I was really excited to try out new things that I had never tried before.
Right. Right. You write that you started out by eating a lot of pizza.
I did.
And then from there, we're present in a community of a lot of other researchers from all over the world, and and sort of started to add to your knowledge that way. I'm curious about the moment, though, that you decided, I don't want to do this medicine stuff anymore. I want to cook. What was that like?
Frightening. It was frightening for me, but it was, I think, even more scarier for my parents, especially my mom, who said, I don't think this is for you because this is a risky business.
Yeah.
And she works in hospitality and management, so she know how it works behind the scenes.
Right.
But what happened was I was working. So at this point, I had moved to D.C. I was working at Georgetown doing research during the day. And then I thought I'd actually end up in D.C. doing some form of health or science policy. So I thought, oh, let's go back to school and get a degree in public policy. So I'm at Georgetown and going to work in the morning doing science and then going to school in the evening doing econometrics and policy, I mean, people behavior.
Yeah.
And I had no creative outlet. I was saturated with academics. And I was cooking a lot for my friends, who then said to me, why don't you do this thing called a food blog? And I kind of had heard about food blogs. I knew they were highly visual mediums. And I said, you know what, this might be just, I'll do it for fun because it gives me an outlet to not really think about work or school life. And that's how a brown table was born.
And you write too, you have a really great visual image in the text in the introduction where you're talking about your first photos for a brown table, and you've got them set, you've got a board on two garbage cans, and that's your studio.
I started really in very frightening conditions. I mean, it worked. I go with the flow. Like, you've got to make things work, so you hack it to make it. So I had no professional training as a photographer. My dad is a professional photographer, but by the time I got to getting my own camera, I had left home. And, you know, cameras are expensive, so my dad kind of said, hey, let's just keep these away because I don't want you guys messing with my professional equipment. So I really didn't have my own camera or even really touch one till I left home and started the blog. So I got a point and shoot camera. I had no inclination or desire to like even learn how to photograph. But the nature of a blog, it's a visual medium, so you're eating with your eyes rather than your mouth. And it forced me to learn food photography. And so I learned how to style food better. I learned how to cook better, and I learned how to photograph better just through trial and error. And at the time, wood was a very popular background in food photographs. This was like 6 to 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we lived in a condo basement, a basement condo, and there was no light. Also, when you're living on the East Coast, the sun goes away really fast.
Yeah.
And I was in school in the evening, so there was no way I could photograph anything during the day, which is what most photographers learn how to do. So I had to learn how to start with artificial light before I got onto natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to take these two wooden planks that I had got from my now husband's parents' farm. They live out on a farm in Virginia, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I would balance these two wood planks on the trash cans. And I had to figure out how to take photographs of food. And, you know, that kind of became the brown table, if you will.
Wow. Well, I asked because the season is one of the most beautifully photographed books of any kind that I've ever seen. I mean, it's not like these are not point and shoot photos, and I wish our audience could see, but it's radio and they can't. So you're just going to have to trust me. This is an absolutely gorgeous, brilliantly produced cookbook with a photo, high color, full bleed photos on, every other page. So how do you go from having this basement studio on top of garbage cans to producing something so, it's just really well done? So I think what I'm asking you is, how did you get to the high end? How did you get from point and shoot to high end?
So a lot of practice, a lot of trial and error, because I always tell people also who are starting out and ask me questions on how to get better at food photography, the main thing is to practice.
Yeah.
Practice, 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 because it's those mistakes that you make when you photograph, you'll never repeat them again, and that's what will teach you how to be a better photographer.
Yeah, sure.
And that's the same thing with cooking. You know, the mistakes that I've learned making, I know how to fix them now, and that's actually made me a much more seasoned and better cook.
Mm-hmm.
That's predominantly how it started. I did not start out big, and I always tell people who are starting out in either field, don't go and blow your money and buy an expensive camera. That's absolutely not worth it. I even hesitate recommending camera models to people, because it's not really about the camera because you could buy the most expensive camera, but you need to kind of understand how to use it, how to control light. You need to learn how to control light. And that's the most important lesson in any type of photography.
Mm-hmm.
I started out with the point and shoot, and there's nothing to be ashamed about that.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated from that to a regular DX SLR, which is not a full frame camera. Once I got comfortable with that, which took me several years, like I think 3.5 years,
mm-hmm.
I finally went and bought a full frame camera, which was probably maybe a year before I actually even got a book deal.
Right.
Without even knowing, at that time, I wasn't even looking for a book, to write a book. And so practice as much as you can. Get comfortable with equipment. Read the manual. The manual is actually probably the best book you have, the best teacher.
The manual is your friend.
Yeah, the manual, especially with cameras, like not so many things. I don't always read a manual for things like the oven and the blender. But with the camera, there is so much knowledge in the book, because with the digital age of photography, there's a lot of information in that computer chip that's in your camera. And so you really have to know how to navigate things and make it work for you.
Yeah, yeah. That's great advice, actually. So I'm also curious about that time in your life where you're cooking as sort of a stress relief and as creative outlet. How long are you in that space before someone says, Nick, you should start a food blog? And then take us through sort of the trajectory of how you went from starting out to becoming a really popular food blogger.
So the thing was, I really never had a vision when I started out. I'm not even confident enough right now to say if I actually have a vision what's down the line, like for the next 2 years,
mm-hmm.
or a year ahead. But what happened was, when I was confident that I had a story to share with people, I said, okay, I think I have something different to tell people. Let me write about it. And so I knew that in mainstream food media, and even in the restaurant world, they weren't really talking about Indian food or food from an immigrant's perspective. And that's something that I was having fun with. So I said, you know what, if people like it, they like it. If they don't like it, they could move on and find information elsewhere for what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I wrote, nothing happened overnight. I cooked, you know, it took a couple of years. And as blog, as you know how blogs work, like it takes time to build traffic and all those things. But I was also never savvy when it came to social media numbers or blog traffic and SEO stuff. I just wrote from my heart, and that's what I've always done.
Yeah.
And I think that is the best thing to do, because those are the stories people connect with. Honestly, those are the stories that I've connected with when I read cookbooks or even articles in magazines.
Mm-hmm. Right. And is that sort of the tone that you took when you started writing for, was it the San Francisco Chronicle?
That is correct. Yeah. So I got approached. So what happened was I was working at a startup in San Francisco at this point as a food photographer. I had won an ISCP award, and we had moved to Oakland. So I'd left my job as a pastry cook at this point. I was working in San Francisco, and I was unhappy where I was because, for one, I was shooting everyone else's food except my own. Mm-hmm. So I had lost one facet of my creative side.
Yeah.
I didn't want to kind of divide anything and say, no, you have to do this or you have to do that. And I was tired of people telling me what to do. And another thing what was happening was my boss was really upset with me at the startup, because my boss said, well, the photos look too nice and customers aren't getting what they're buying. And so can you decrease the quality of your work? And as a creative person, that is the most unsatisfying experience you could ever have. And so I said, you know, I don't think to myself, I don't think this is going to work out long term, because you're depressed right now.
Yeah.
And you don't want to lose the one thing that you sacrificed so much to do.
Yeah,
you don't want to lose your love for that. So I said, let me go and look for freelance jobs. Uh-huh. So I reached out to a couple of people, reached out to the editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. And I said, his name is Paolo Lucchesi. And I said, hey, Paolo, can we meet up? And, you know, here's my resume. These are the photographs I've taken. I'm looking for freelance food photo jobs. And he said, sure, let's meet up. And so we met up. We talked a lot about what my passions were. And then he comes back after 2 weeks and says, hey, so we took a look at your work. We really like it. But we're thinking you should write a regular food column for us. Oh, and you can do what you want. And I said, are you sure you really want me to do that? Because that's not what I asked for.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, yeah, I want you to do what you want. I want you to write from your soul and create recipes that you're really passionate about. And I don't care like how crazy they might sound.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said, do that, I said, wow, this guy really believes in me and my work. So I need to give this a shot. And so I've been doing that now for more than 2.5 years. And it's been one of the best and the most amazing opportunities that I've ever wished for.
Right. Are you sort of creating your own recipes basically from the start when you start writing for the San Francisco Chronicle? Did you have an eye towards recipe development basically back then? How did you start out when you were deciding what you were going to write about now that you were a food writer?
Yeah, so I had already, by now I had experience writing for a couple of independent magazines as well in both print and digital format. And then I had also gained experience from the blog. So I kind of knew a little bit about what people wanted from a home cook's standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love flavor. More than anything, the only thing I really want to talk about with people is flavor. How mm-hmm. do we make home cooking easy? And how do we make it flavorful without compromising an item?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I really wanted to do with the column. So my focus with the column is always on, let's introduce a new ingredient to people, but let's keep it easy and simple. So people can have fun in the kitchen. You get a bigger bang for your buck, so to speak. And hopefully you're enjoying the food that you eat mm-hmm. and making it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the attitude I go in with the column.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, too, when you talk about ingredients, if you have thought a lot about people, readers being able to get what you're cooking with, maybe in some, non-metro areas.
Yeah. So one of the things I've been trying to introduce people to, and I've tried to do this with the book as well, is to introduce people to a couple of ingredients that they've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
But they've always seen them being used in a traditional Indian setting.
Mm-hmm.
One is jaggery, which is the most unrefined form of sugar that you could find. It's basically sugarcane juice, mm-hmm. straight from the plant, or coconut or juice from the palm tree, like such as a coconut tree. And what they do is they boil it to concentrate the liquid, and you get a solid at the end. And it's an unrefined form of sugar, so it's rich in minerals, it's rich in salts. And so it's not only sweet, it's actually not that sweet, which is amazing, but it adds a very distinct, unique flavor profile. So I've been trying to introduce people to an unusual sweetener like that, which is normally used in Indian dishes to make sauces and condiments, as well as sweetened curries and stews like that. So I've been trying to showcase, hey, you can also use this in your regular baking. So I did a chocolate chip cookie with hazelnut flour in the book, using that as the main sweetener. Tamarind is another ingredient that I really love, so I've tried to showcase it in different ways, from making it into drinks. There's the tamarind ginger refresh in the book, which is so simple. And then things like, you know, like curry leaves. Curry leaves have predominantly been used in Southeast Asian cooking, especially in Indian food. And we've always talked about them used in curries, you know, to season dishes. But I kind of wanted to do it much more like in a fun way beyond what was already known, because I'm always about, if I have nothing new to contribute to the conversation, there's no point in me writing about it because someone else has done a better job.
Right.
So what can I bring to the table? So I did like a curry leaf popcorn chicken in the book, which surprisingly has been one of the most popular recipes that people are cooking all over the country and the world now. So that's been... It's just been amazing just to see the response that people are excited to see these ingredients have a place outside what was already known. And they're having fun with it at the end of the day. And that's what makes me happy.
Right. So how did you go from blog to book?
So at the time, I had no desire to write a book when all this happened. I was working at the startup that I mentioned earlier. And a couple of years ago, I saw a lot of my friends getting cookbook deals. And I said, you know, maybe I should write a cookbook too, because it seems like a natural kind of transition, career transition. And I reached out to an agent who had done an interview on a site. And I said, hey, would you be interested in looking at my work? And she had put out an open call for people to submit their work. And, you know, like she said she would read it. So I reached out to her, sent my work that I'd done, and she said, I don't think your work deserves a book because you have nothing to say. And I, you know, having come from a science background, I'm used to taking criticism. So I said, I guess she's right. Maybe there's honestly nothing I really have to tell people. So I, you know, didn't really think too much about it, and I gave up on the idea of writing a book.
Wait, but why? What was her reasoning?
She just felt that I didn't. I mean, it was literally like a one or two liner. And I know agents are busy. All she said was, I don't think your work deserves a platform. And I don't think you have anything unique to say.
That's harsh.
But I think one of the things that you're trained in science is to get harsh responses from your professor. So you're always shut down.
So it helped you.
And so, I mean, I was upset. Don't get me wrong. But you have to move on. You can't like sit and focus on that. You know, I said, well, at least let me just focus on my work now. And so that's what I did for the next couple of years. And when I was, I think, the second IACP conference, an agent reached out to me. And, of course, in between the time, I had chatted with a couple of other agents that had started to reach out as my work started getting recognized. And I never clicked with anyone. At that point, an agent reached out to me. Her name was Maria, and Maria reached out to me, and we bonded immediately. And I had never had that experience with any other agent that I chatted with. We met up in person when I visited New York, and we clicked. When we clicked, I said, okay, you know, even if I don't do a book right now, this is someone who has my best interest at heart. She wanted me to write. She believed in my work, and she made me more confident. And so I said, hey, you know, I've never done a book before. I've been shot down before, so I don't know if I have anything unique to tell. And she said, no, you have a unique story to tell. So let's see what happens. So we worked on a proposal together for about, I think, 6 or 8 months. We drafted a proposal. She went out, shopped it out to different publishers. It went into auction, and then I signed up with Chronicle Books. And they've been such an amazing team to work with.
Yeah, that's. I'm coming back now to just gushing again about how beautifully done the book is. Can you talk to me a little bit about the production process with Chronicle Books, and maybe speak to how, what was that like being responsible for all the photos and all the text for your cookbook?
So I've been very fortunate to have an extremely supportive team. My editor, Sarah Billingsley, is amazing at Chronicle Books. I had a designer named Alice Chow, who was so instrumental into creating a beautiful design that I was really happy with. She sat down with me. We had several meetings on design where she created different formats, picked different fonts based on my personality. So it was kind of like meeting a psychologist, if you will.
Oh.
Like, yeah. So it was a really interesting process since I had never done a book.
Yeah.
She sat down with me, asked me about my likes and dislikes, what I liked in cookbooks, what I didn't like in cookbooks. And then she actually came up with a font for the book, a font for the text, a color scheme, and a layout for the photos and the text and how everything would be placed. And then we went through several iterations, just going back and forth of how this would work, what didn't work. And I am so fortunate to have had a say in every stage of production.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor was, she is amazing. I love her to death. And I think that's what really works for a book and an author, is when everybody's really involved and it feels like everyone's emotionally connected, which they are, and it's a team effort.
So did you have a book's worth of recipes ready to go, or did you sort of develop on the way?
A little bit of both. So initially when I wrote the proposal, I had ideas that I had always like had at the back of my mind that I wanted to write in this book. And so I had a couple. So the book has a little over 100 recipes. And so at the time I said, hey, you know, these are my ideas. Let's put them down in these chapters rough. And they said, it's fine if it changes along the way. And which is eventually what happened, because you also have, and I did this, I had my readers, I put a call out and had them test things to see how it worked for them. And then I made changes consequently as things went on.
Mm-hmm.
But more or less, I kind of had a concept in my mind. And I think that's really helpful. Once you have an idea and where you want to go, it helps you waste less time as you write the book.
Do you mean that you had sort of a guideline for the layout, and you sort of knew based on your talks with the people on the production team where certain recipes would go and where certain photos would go, and then you sort of developed as you went?
So with the book, we had all the chapters already organized. So it's a very easy, user-friendly recipe index, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got like stuff sorted by the type of protein. So you've got seafood, eggs and poultry, grains and vegetables, appetizers, drinks, sweets. So that made it easy. And then as for the photos, I asked, and they were actually really excited about this, to have at least one photo for each dish. And then the recipes that I felt needed a bit more instruction. So I feel sometimes people learn better by photos or video versus words.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a recipe called the potato chops, which is basically an Indian dumpling, if you will, with mashed potatoes and ground lamb stuffed. And so I said, I think that's something that would really benefit from instruction. So let's do visual photos. And so I did that.
Uh-huh.
And they worked with me to include all those things to make it as user-friendly as possible.
Okay. So you probably have a couple favorite recipes in this book. Can you talk about a few of them?
Yeah. So one of my favorite recipes, I kind of hinted at this earlier, is the potato chops, which is based, everybody loves mashed potatoes wherever you go.
Yeah.
With meat, it's an even bigger win. My husband loves that. So
yeah.
I decided, let me do this from my own way. So I did this potato chop that is something that I grew up with. So that's in the book. There is rhubarb, which I roasted with cardamom to make a drink,
mm-hmm.
and splashed a little bit of rose water in there. It's a beautiful drink in summer that you can have, and it's so easy to prepare. Then I've done a Bombay frittata, which is basically influenced by my life in Cincinnati, where I experienced having feta cheese for the first time, seeing feta cheese in omelets. And so instead of using feta, I used paneer, which is also a cheese that's made by curdling milk and can hold its structure when it's heated.
Mm-hmm.
And it works so well in this. So that's something that one of my favorite recipes. Another one is the lemon pickle. This is really special because Indian pickles are usually made with mustard oil, which is banned in America and in many countries in the West. but and that it's banned for health reasons. Wow. But I was able to develop a recipe using olive oil from California with the same spices and make it work with lemon. So I really love that recipe. It's special to me because I was able to conquer my fears with that.
You're able to conquer your fears of what?
Of not being able to ever use mustard oil and make a pickle that always used mustard oil, but help create that same flavor profile.
Did you spend years thinking, oh, I can't make that. I can't make all this whole range of things because of this one ingredient that I can't get that I've never heard of actually.
Yeah, so it's been a challenge kind of sharing. Also, a lot of this northern states in India use mustard oil in their cooking, but because it contains a chemical that is known to cause heart disease, or is rather connected with, no one's actually proven it, but no one's been able to show any results in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a challenge for me. Then how do I recreate a flavor because something is unavailable?
Right.
And
what's the flavor profile of mustard oil?
It's like horseradish.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful oil. It has a high smoke point. It's actually unsaturated, so it's really healthy otherwise, except for this one chemical.
Except for the heart disease thing.
Yeah. And it's also, if you're familiar with canola oil.
Yeah.
Canola oil was, they're all from the same family, the rapeseed family, the Ruffana brassica family. And so canola oil was bred from a certain type of Ruffana brassica plant to eliminate that chemical. And that's why it's called Canada oil or it was, yeah. And so, you know, but it doesn't have that nice wasabi kind of flavor.
Right.
And olive oil, of course, doesn't provide that. But I can get the taste of the spices, and it reminds me of that pickle in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the recipes I was really proud of.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you have predecessors in this area of rethinking Indian recipes, you know, to match ingredients that are possible to find in the United States. Are you aware of anybody else doing that work?
To be honest, there are a few people that are doing some amazing work in Indian cooking. One of my favorite people is this chef, Asha Gomes, she lives in the South in Atlanta. And she wrote a book a couple of years ago called My Two Souths. And she does a lot of amazing thing with Indian ingredients. And she's also from the South in India. So she's blending the South twice, as I like to say. She's got the Indian influence and then the influence from Atlanta. And her food is amazing. I cooked from her book. And her fried chicken and waffles is one of my favorite recipes. You've got, there's a chef in San Francisco who does amazing work. And his restaurant is at a hotel called the Taj Campton. His name is Srijit Gopinath. And his food is amazing. He's trained at the CIA, so his food is more fine dining. But I've never seen people do Indian fine dining in the way he does.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a poem when you go in there. The food is beautifully composed and makes sense.
Do you find yourself learning then from other people the tricks that you can sort of bring back into your own kitchen? Because you're very much a home cook and a home cooking writer. Are there some other influences that help you keep you learning?
Yeah. So I look to home cooks always for just understanding how they, you know, look at their readers and how they make life for their readers easier.
Mm-hmm.
Nigella Lawson is one of my favorite people, and you're familiar with her. I don't think anybody needs an introduction. Nigella.
That's right.
She's an amazing champion for home cooks. You've got Diana Henry, who's an Irish-based author. Well, she's Irish but lives in London. She's an amazing author and has written several books on cooking for home cooks, and they're so user-friendly. Yatim Ottolenghi is another whiz at when it comes to Middle Eastern food and is a Jewish food, Israeli food, and his food is just so rich in flavor, but it's easy. You've got American authors like Julia Tershin, who's also wonderful, and she is an amazing champion of home cooks as well. And she's got a lot of tricks in her mind making things easy.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that have actually really inspired me along my own journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look up to them quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take you as a food blogger to feel like you were ready to take on a book?
I still don't know. like, what did I do? I think once I kind of knew that I had a story to tell people, I felt confident enough to write it. Yeah. I said, let me go ahead and do this.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the writing part of this. Having talked about the photography and then about how you like to develop recipes and the energy that comes from being in the kitchen. What about when you sit down to write, you have words to produce? Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process for you?
Writing has always been the most challenging part of my job because I didn't start out as a writer. Mm-hmm. I was experienced in writing for science, and writing for food media is a very different ballgame. Mm-hmm. But I always write from my heart, and I either want to share a personal story or a story about an ingredient or a food so that people connect with it. Because at the end of the day, I want people to want to read that story, not once, but at least twice, hopefully.
Yeah.
And they should connect with it. It should make them want to cook the food. So I try to do that and come from a personal perspective because that's the best perspective that I can share.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to introduce them to new ingredients. So if I talk about food, its culture, whether it's positive or negative about that ingredient or that culture, I think those stories need to be told, and it's been a wonderful way to do that.
One of the things that we do on this show is ask guests to issue a writing prompt for listeners, and it sounds like you're coming to something like that. If you could boil down what you were just saying about, you know, wanting to sort of come from the heart.
Mm-hmm.
What do you tell yourself when you're sitting down to write something that you really don't want to write because you'd really rather be in the kitchen or behind the camera or mm-hmm. doing anything else but sitting in the chair and typing on a keyboard? How do you get yourself going?
Sure. So I think the most important thing for me to remember is that people should be interested about what I write. A recipe by itself is just a recipe.
Sure.
It's pretty much an experiment with instructions. And so what I try to do is even the most inconvenient thing that might be, and it's usually something very personal, I think it's okay to be vulnerable when you write.
Yeah.
That is something that I had to kind of work with and become comfortable with because I think people kind of connect with you better then, because every time I write something now, I realize I'm opening a part of my life out to the world.
Yeah.
And those, you know, not everyone will like it. And that's not always the purpose of writing. But it also helps people think that, hey, at least in my case, it was about telling people, hey, I might not look or sound like you, but, you know, I still want to be accepted by you. I still want to be a part of your world. And I hope you'd be a part of mine. Yes. And that is what I want to do.
Yeah, it's like starting a conversation.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And then keeping the reader's interest long enough to that they go to the store and they get the ingredients and they come back and they try the recipe.
Exactly.
Yeah. Have you done much in the way of appearances for the book? Do you enjoy connecting with people around the idea of the book in person?
I do. I actually enjoy meeting with people because I've never had the opportunity until now to actually travel across the country and talk to them. So there are people that I've met that are reading the newspaper column who have also read the blog for many years. And it's so nice just to meet them in person and interact. So it's mm-hmm. fun. And they tell me their stories. One of the most amazing things about this process, so I've been on a really crazy book tour, and I'm on tour till the end of December.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, and I'm also traveling internationally. So I'm leaving for London next month to promote my book. I'm going to the UAE, and then I'll be New Zealand in December. But one of the most amazing things about all these things is meeting up with people who are immigrants, who feel so excited and represented just for me. Mm-hmm. And to see this book out there because they see themselves getting a voice.
Yeah.
And to have that support for me means the world.
Yeah.
I could have never expected that kind of a response because you can't predict, especially when you're writing a book for the first time, you have no idea what's going to happen.
Right.
But to have that heartwarming response from people means the world to me. and they share their stories with me. And they want to write, some of them want to write books, and some of them just want to tell me something about their moms or their grandmothers, or, you know, like, what were their experience moving to America or wherever they've moved, and what it is like to live at home, how they cook at home. And so I feel so happy that I've been blessed to have this opportunity to connect with people.
Mm-hmm. And your parents, your photographer father, and your hospitality industry mother, did they get to a place where they were more comfortable, especially your mom, to a place where she was more comfortable with your career pivot?
I think kind of the accolades helped a little bit. Good, yeah. Slow. And I think, like, initially, of course, it was tough because she has worked in the hospitality industry and she knows how hard it is. For her to now see me be able to support myself and also just be recognized for her work, I know it makes her really proud. So she's really excited about that. So, you know, my mom's like my big champion now. She has got my cookbook, and the last she told me was that she was going to a family funeral, and she was going to show the book around because everyone was traveling from all over the world for the funeral. And I said, I don't know if that's a good idea, Mom. But she said, nope. This is how we're going to do it. And I said, okay.
That sounds like acceptance and pride to me.
Yeah. And so it's wonderful just to have that from my family. Yeah.
Yeah. Nick, I'm going to wrap up our talk now. I've really enjoyed getting to speak with you. And I love the book. It's Seasons, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food by Nick Sharma, by Chronicle Books, out now. And Nick is touring the country and soon the world. So Nick, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, and you've just heard Kim McQueen speaking with the author Nick Sharma about his new book, Season, Big Flavors, Beautiful Food, just out from Chronicle Books. You can find Nick's blog at abrowntable.com. So if you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Have a great week.